Either she homeless or she got problems. That's the only reason why she run to a black man.
I like him already.
Now you wanna get nuts? Come on!
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome.
Producer, director, writer. He is the ultimate filmmaker and bona fide foodie. You're listening to The Quiddituzz Factor with Michael J. Arbouet.
Hello, my friends. Thank you and welcome to another episode of The Quiddituzz Factor. I'm your host, Michael J. Arbouet. And before we begin, that strange word that you heard just now, quiddituzz, what does it mean? Adriana, please give them the definition.
Quiddituzz, Latin, the whatness of a thing, the essential nature of something, the quality that makes a thing what it is.
That's exactly right. Quiddituzz is the whatness or essence of a thing or person. And in today's episode, we're going to be talking with an Academy Award-winning writer, Alex Daenerys. And what makes his story so fun and unique is that he didn't always believe that his dreams would come true. It was a hard road. In this episode, I want to talk about faith because it's something that a lot of people lack, and it's what eventually keeps you going. It's something that gets you through the hard times of life. You know, the hardest times often lead to the greatest moments in your life. Keep the faith and it will all be worth it in the end. And I absolutely believe that's true. And so that's what I want to put out there to you guys, is that things are going to get hard. Things are not always going to work out. And when you're feeling down and low, you have to turn around and believe in yourself. So let's listen to the story of how Alex became an Academy Award-winning writer. Without any further ado, let's welcome to the show Alex Daenerys. Alex, hello. How you doing? Welcome.
Hello there.
So I always like to start the show with an origin story. Tell me about 8-year-old Alex. Did you always want to be a writer?
No. I mean, at 8 years old, I didn't know what I think I wanted to play for the New York Yankees. I lived in a little town called East Rockaway. In Nassau County on the South Shore of Long Island. And my house was on Maxwell Street, and it was literally straight across from my house was the side of a big old movie house called the Criterion Movie Theater.
Oh yeah, I know where that is.
You remember where that is?
Yeah, yeah.
Right on Atlantic Avenue in Maxwell there. And it used to be a huge movie house. It's not anymore, not for a long time. But when I was a kid, it was. And it was one of those movie theaters that played one film, you know, over and over again. It wasn't a multiplex. It was just huge red curtains and a balcony in one of those great old theaters. And I didn't have the greatest of home lives. So I used to escape into that movie theater at 8, 9, 10 years old. And when people were coming out of the side, I would sneak in. And I thought I was being crafty, but later on I found out that the owner knew I was there. He just didn't care. He knew I loved the movies. So I used to watch, you know, the same movie over and over all day until after dark, until I had to sneak home. So I would see movies that were way too grown up for what I should have been watching. Things like in 79 would have been like And Justice for All or The Great Santini, or those are the movies that sort of shaped me even when I was that young. And I fell in love with movies. But I didn't know, I was never a writer. I went to high school to where we went, right? I went to Maria Regina, which became St. Agnes, which became Kellenberg.
Yeah.
And when I was at St. Agnes, I met Mr. Siller, Russell Siller, who just passed away this year. Heartbreaking for me, one of those teachers that changes your life. And he put me on stage for the first time, and I fell in love with it. And after that, I thought I'd be an actor for an hour and a half, and then I wanted to be a theater director. And that's how it went. Till much, much further in my life, but we could talk about that later. So no, I didn't always know I wanted to be a writer. I didn't become a writer per se until I was in my 30s.
Wow.
I got there in a strange road.
So let's go to our high school days. So, you joined theater and you fell in love with duty. So did you think you'd be working in the theater world?
I hoped immediately. It was the one thing that clicked with me. I forgot all about baseball and I fell in love with theater. And Mr. Siller, Russ Siller, put me in my first show in my junior year, Fiddler on the Roof. Mm-hmm. I was a skinny Puerto Rican Armenian Tevye. But I fell in love with it so bad. And then wasn't a year later that I already wanted to start sort of directing plays and doing my own thing. And so that's what I spent the rest of my time doing, trying to study how to direct theater. But I was broke. And I mean, there were times when it was tough for me to get, you know, a good meal every day, or keep my electricity on. So I found my way into the restaurant business, and it was hard working all those hours and then trying to direct or do something. I didn't have anywhere else to fall, and I had to make my own money. So high school, and I just want to go in order so I don't skip, but high school for me was that bell that rang for a kid that was really lost. And the minute I felt it, I knew I loved it. And I knew that it was the one thing I wanted to do. And I just, I don't know, it's a miracle. I stayed at it, and I got a lot of help from a lot of people and got lucky, and hopefully I had some talent, and it worked out.
So did you pursue a theater degree in college? How did that work out?
Yeah, I had a year off in between because I couldn't afford college. And I got some schools, accepted some good theater schools, but even with the scholarships they were offering, I couldn't afford to go. So I had this year off that was pretty crazy, and I lived alone in an apartment in Lynbrook, Long Island. And then this one little school in South Florida, Barry University, called and said, "We want you to come down and take a look." And I went down and I spoke to the dean of the arts, Patricia Minaw, who's passed away as well since then. And she said, "We want you here." And I said, "Well, I can't afford it." And she said, "Well, we're going to make it affordable." And they paid my full ride for what ended up being 2 years. And after 2 years, you know, I don't know. I was a little bit, I had my issues, and I wanted to get back to New York. And I left college after 2 years. But they were great years. And then I came back to New York and started working in the restaurant business and sort of doing regional theater. I regretted that. And then I was blessed a few years ago, Barry University came back and gave me an honorary degree, which meant the world to me. My kids got to see me get my degree from college. So wow. That was really special. And it hangs on my wall right next to me. I'm really proud of it. So yeah, I spent 2 years in the college, but then went out and really sort of educated myself with lots of books on theory, you know, anything I could get my hands on to teach me about theory and stuff. And I would devour them. I would read them over and over and over. And that's sort of how I got my education.
Wow. That's great. So tell me about the first like real job that you had. I guess it started in theater. Tell me about that moment and how that developed.
God, I don't even remember the first job I got paid for. There's a regional theater in Long Island called Arena Stage out in Farmingdale. Mm-hmm. And I got cast in a play there, Stalag 17, I think it was. And it was the first time I ever got a check for being there, whatever it was, worth $70. I have no idea. But that was the first time I ever got paid. And I really, you know, I did my own stuff with friends, and friends I still have to this day. We could talk about that in my company Lexicon, but we had a comedy troupe that went, you know, played in the city and did some things. And we tried to do our own showcases and things like that. It certainly wasn't the traditional route. And I didn't really get, you know, paid a great amount until people started getting me to write. And I didn't think I was a writer, but people thought I was. And so that's where it started to blossom.
Okay. So I guess tell me about that first time where you decided to write, because I've heard this story before, like, you know, even people have told me that I should write, and I didn't write until I was 49 years old.
Yeah.
What sparked that for you?
Well, I was managing a restaurant in Manhattan. I'd moved into the city. This is around 1999, maybe. And I was miserable because all my time was spent in the restaurant business. I wasn't doing any theater, and I just felt lost. And I packed my car up, and my mom lives in Pembroke Pines, Florida, along with my sister. They were in New York earlier, but then they moved there in 85 or 86. And I packed my car up, and I just was like, I'm done with this. I was managing a, you know, really good restaurant in the city, but I was just miserable. I was drinking my face off till all hours of the morning and not happy. And But while I was there, I had a friend named Natasha, who was an actress who was going to do a scene for her class at Stella Adler, the teacher from Stella Adler. And she was, and she couldn't find anything. And she asked me if I knew anything that would work for her. And I didn't know, but I knew her as an actress. And I thought, what a, for a goof. I wrote a one act for her to act in. And it was funny because I handed it to her, but I put a fake name on it. Cause I didn't want to, you know, I just put a fake name on it and I didn't say anything. She said, oh my God, this is great. I'm going to do this. And they went into class and she did it and it worked out really well. And, I finally said, you know, I have to admit this in case anybody asks you what the hell you just did. I wrote it. And so, and the instructor had said to me, you know, you're a really good writer, after she found out I wrote it. And I said, I'm not a writer. And she said, oh, darling, yes, you are. Just keep doing it. So then I took a shot and I wrote another play. Sorry. So let me go backwards. I apologize. So then I quit that restaurant. I packed up my car. I was miserable. I went to Florida, be with my mom and my best friend in the whole world from East Rockaway, who we were high school friends. We were friends in grammar school, became really close friends in high school. His name's Chris McCartan. And he was in the city and he knew I went down and I was in Florida for 3 months. I got a job selling wine. I was literally just running away. But Chris, my good friend, and we should all have these people, call me up. And he said, after 3 months, he said, how's it going? I said, it's good. I got a job, you know, selling wine and this and that. And Chris said, yeah, that's terrific. I'm going to come down there this weekend and we're going to pack your car and you're coming back to New York. And I was like, yeah, buddy, all right, I appreciate it. You know, he's like, no, you're coming back to New York and you're going to sleep on my floor and you're going to write. And that's what you're going to do. So I'm getting a one-way ticket and I'll be there this weekend. I just thought he was the best friend in the world. I said, thanks, man. I really appreciate it. I'll let you know when I'm in trouble or whatever. Well, God bless him. That Friday, he showed up at my house in Florida and showed me his one-way ticket. And we spent the weekend with my family. We packed my car and we drove back to New York right before 9/11. It was August of 2001. And he was a single man in his 30s and he let me sleep. Like, I was the John Belushi character, just sleeping. I was the Jack Black character for the younger folks, sleeping on his living room floor with nothing but my computer. And he used to put money on the table in the mornings in case I needed a bite. Like, it's as good as a friend can get. And I wrote a play on his floor or at the computer in his apartment, sleeping on his floor, called Folding the Monster. Mm-hmm. And that play somehow got to Danny Aiello. And Danny Aiello from Do the Right Thing, the Oscar-nominated actor, Moonstruck. Danny fell in love with it, wanted to do it. We did a bunch of readings. That got me to my manager, which got me the agents. And that's how the ball started. So an act of kindness by my dearest friend gave me the break. That feels like a lottery ticket now.
Wow, that's amazing. That he just had this belief in you and you just ran with it.
He had a belief in me and he was as good a friend. You know, he's as good as my brother. You know, some people like, there are people in your lives that are going to lift you up sometime, you know, and mm-hmm. and you got to be open to that. And he was one of those people that lifted me up without ever making me feel bad about it, without ever making me feel like less than a man about it. He just believed, and God love him because we're still dear friends. And he changed my whole life.
Wow. After you wrote that first initial play, what would you consider that first job that you said, I'm a writer, this is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life?
Well, what happened was Folding the Monster went around and we did a bunch of readings. We had amazing actors do it. Like when I think of all the talent that did readings of that play, it's really hard to get a play finally done. It was a kitchen sink play and it was Danny. And we did it with Deborah Winger. We did it with Annabella Sciorra. In the end, we did it with Rosie O'Donnell, who was downright brilliant. Her and Danny were brilliant. And we were at Manhattan Theater Club and we almost did it. It fell apart because things fall apart. But what happened was we were doing a reading and Danny's manager was a guy named Johnny Planka, who passed away also this past year with Danny. So my heart, Siller, the yeah. three guys that made my life, Johnny Planka, Danny Aiello, and Russell Siller from high school all died this past year. And boy, if you want a 1-2-3 punch to people that made my career happen. But Danny's manager was Johnny Planka, and Johnny Planka managed the likes of Peter O'Toole, Anthony Quinn, Lauren Bacall, like his, you wouldn't believe it. He was a legend. And he saw me outside the theater in intermission for one of the Folding the Monster readings. And he said, hey, kid, you want a manager? And I was like, you? And he said, yeah. And I said, I'll be the only person on your client list that I don't know. And he smiled at me with his cigar in his mouth. And he said, nonetheless, you're really talented and I'd like to represent you. And so Johnny Planko, for some, I was sleeping on a floor in Brooklyn. Like, I was totally broke, but somehow Johnny Planko became my manager, which was insane. Wow. Then my dad passed away, and my dad was my absolute hero. And he passed away of pancreatic cancer, and my whole life got shook. And not less than a year later, I married my wife, Nyla, who will be married 15 years this August. So my dad died January 27th. I married Nyla August 20th of 2005. And I couldn't write anything when my dad died. I was the kid. I was the writer. We were best friends. Everybody knew how close we were. And everybody's waiting for me to write something, you know, to honor him. And I couldn't do it. I couldn't write a thing. I didn't write a thing. I mumbled. I still don't know what I said, but I don't know. I was crying and I did my best. But after I married Nylan, she encouraged me as much as Chris did. I started writing a play about a girl who was a photographer who couldn't take pictures because her father had passed. And anyway, I wrote a play about my father's death through the eyes of this female protagonist in a play called Still Life. And Still Life was the play that changed my life. Johnny showed that to Olivier Sultan, who's my agent from CAA. He fell in love with it, so I got signed by CAA. Then Alejandro Iñárritu, the 5-time Oscar-winning genius, was just splitting up with his writer at the time. They had differences and separated ways, and he had read Still Life because CAA gave it to him, and he fell in love with it. So he called me, and I went out to California, and then we started working on a film called Beautiful together. And all of a sudden, you know, me and Alejandro have done, you know, we started on Beautiful. We did Birdman, Revenant. We're doing more. He's become my brother. Yeah. And then the, you know, like the crazy ass story that is my life just unfolded through a series of unlikely events.
Okay. So now that you mentioned it, I've been dying to talk about it. Tell me about Birdman and how you won the Academy Award. Take me down that journey.
I had worked with Alejandro. I'd met him on Beautiful. And for artistic reasons, this sounds insane because it was my first big film, but for artistic reasons, I resigned from Beautiful. No animosity. Everybody always thinks there is. We totally understood each other. I wrote a couple of drafts. He wanted to do something else. I felt strongly about one thing. Didn't matter. We respected each other. And my agent stopped talking to me because they thought I was difficult or whatever, but it wasn't like that. I just didn't think I could honor what he wanted to do. So a year later, I was down in Puerto Rico because I go away to write when I'm writing actual pages, not research or outline, but I go away to Puerto Rico or Dominican Republic or somewhere I could be just without distraction. And I got a call from Alejandro and he said, listen, I have this idea. It's a comedy in one take, a dark comedy in one take, and I'd like you to do it with me. And I said, dude, we have unfinished business and nothing would make me happier than to do that with you. And then he asked me if I would mind working with the guy, Nico Giacobone, who replaced me on Beautiful. So it was a little weird because I didn't know him. But I was like, sure, let's just do it. Let's just do it, you know. And I met Nico and it wasn't like he was looking at me with the side eye and I was looking at him with the side eye, you know, because and it didn't take us 2 days before we realized that we were brothers. And so Nico and me and Alejandro and our friend Armando, who's Nico's cousin, got together and started breaking story. Alejandro had a really sort of sketchy idea about what he wanted to do. And it sort of evolved. It became very different. There was no Birdman in the first version of it. It was an actor going to it. It turned into a theater. So Alejandro, Armando, Nico, and I would have sessions brainstorming story and everything else. And then Nico and I would go away and write the script, the pages. We'd bring it back. Alejandro would give his ideas, suggestions, yeses, nos, wants. And we took us about a year and 3 months before we came up with the draft that worked. And Birdman is this really rare beast because as the genius, two geniuses, Alejandro for one, let's be honest, and Emmanuel Lubezki, Chivo, they're just, the director of photography, are just two incredibly inspired people. And since it was going to be one shot and they planned it, Nico and I knew that our script was going to have to stand because there was nowhere to edit it. You couldn't rewrite. You couldn't do anything in the cut because there were these really, really long takes that seemed together as one long film. So our shooting draft is incredibly close to exactly what you see on the screen, because we, once the time came, we really couldn't change very much because it was already timed out and mapped out. So it was a high wire act, and it was amazing. And we never, I mean, we thought it'd be a, you know, an indie film that a few people dug. Like when you think about it, like Michael Keaton, who, you know, wasn't in the front and center back then, you know, he'd been, you know, semi-retired or done a few little movies, but in his underwear at the beginning of a movie. And you're like, this is, who's going to watch this movie? And then we watched it, you know, take on this life of its own. And it, I still can't quite explain it, but.
When I saw the film, it had so many levels to it. Like, I felt like I was listening to a story within a story within a story. And you couldn't not watch it. You know, you got sucked in, and you just had to stay and see how it was going to end, you know?
Right.
I mean, I remember just getting sucked in, and then, you know, when I found out, like, maybe it was like a year or 2 years later, someone from Kellenberg said, you know, that guy went to Maria Regina. And I was like, what, really? You know? And it's funny. And then I don't even know how you met my brother, because, you know, the funny thing with my brother and me is that I went to film school, you know, I lived in California for a little bit. My brother never went to film school. He never did any of that. He kind of saw what I was doing, because there's a 7-year difference between us. And I'd kind of gotten jaded, because I was like a big fish in a small pond. I went to Post.
Right.
You know, I was second in my class at Post. So I thought, okay, I'm definitely going to make it. And then I didn't, you know, and it was weird because I had all these friends around me who had made it. I don't know if you know, what's his name? Ed Burns.
Sure.
Yeah. But Ed Burns went to Chaminade, you know, so.
I didn't know he went to Chaminade. I never knew that.
He went to Chaminade. And
did he take bubble baths? Cause that was the, do you remember that? Everybody used to put Chaminade boys in bubble baths.
Yeah, he went to Chaminade.
I love Chaminade, right?
Everybody. I went to Kellenberg. We both knew some of the same brothers. And the big difference was, I mean, it was so weird. He was interning at ABC. I was interning at NBC. And the big difference was that I hadn't finished my film. He finished his film, and on a whim, as he was running out the door, he handed a copy to Robert Redford, who took it and put it into.
That was Brothers McMullen?
Yes, that was Brothers McMullen.
That's amazing. That's the craziness of this stupid business.
So it's like, you know, so I always felt kind of lost. So I always wanted to hear your story, because I'm just like, you know, I didn't know, like, how you made it and, like, what happened and your whole story.
No, man. I spend my time, and I think there's a lot of us that listen to this, right? You spend a lot of your time thinking you're a fraud. You think to yourself, I've fooled people just enough to get where I am. I still have dreams, you know, where I wake up and I'm, you know, waiting on tables, which I did for 24 years. So I'm very affectionate toward restaurant folks. But I still have dreams that somebody's going to wake me up and say, hey, buddy, table 11, get the bread and butter. And I'm gonna be like, what are you talking about? I won an Oscar. I write that. And they're like, yeah, get the hell over there and serve the bread. Like, I still don't feel like any of it's real in a way. Like, it's just a very surreal, you have to, it's an act of faith in a way, right? Mm-hmm. You need breaks, you need talent, you need, everything has to be the perfect storm for it to work out. I met your brother, to answer your question, as I've met two or three people in an argument online. He and I were arguing, and we went at it. And I was like, well, I don't know who you are. I disagree 100% with you, but why don't we get together and talk this out? And we met at a restaurant called Paul and Jimmy's, which is right near where I live on 18th Street. Amazing Italian restaurant, Paul and Jimmy's, there's my plug. And Kevin met me there, your brother. And we talked and we laughed and I liked him immediately. And I was like, send me your scripts or whatever. And we started working briefly on the Bumpy Johnson thing, but then we got swept up by the people that Lawrence Fishburne and those guys. But yeah, that's how we met. We met through an argument online. And I'm always interested in people that argue. I've done it a lot. where I just feel like I need to meet you. I might hate you, but I need to meet you. And that's how it happened.
Oh, that's so funny.
Yeah.
So my next question to you is, quiditas, that word, means the whatness or essence of a person or thing. And to make it easy for the people in the audience, let's relate quiditas also means your magic power. What would your magic power be? What is your quiditas?
Let me try to answer it. I feel like an idiot, but my magic power is this, and this is hard for me to say. Ever since I'm a little kid in that movie theater, and I'm watching stuff or reading stuff or seeing a play or a film or reading a book, there's a moment in that book or play, and maybe people who are listening to this or you might identify with this, I don't know, because it's going to sound crazy. There's a moment when something happens, and it doesn't have to be a sad thing, right? It's not a sad thing, but something happens and my whole body has the urge to cry. Like I feel the tears, and it might be a happy moment. It might be just a shot. It might be, but I literally get the feeling, or a piece of dialogue or a piece of acting. And I get that feeling, and that forever has been my truth meter. So when I've seen performances or directed people, I know it's right when I get that feeling. And it has nothing to do with being sad, but somehow my response is to cry. I don't get it.
I know exactly what you mean.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
I know exactly. I get that feeling when I meet someone that I really click with. I almost feel like I'm going to get brought to tears because we are such kindred spirits.
I love that. That's exactly how I feel. And I feel like when I hear the right piece of dialogue or when I write something myself, like if it doesn't get me upset or whatever, then I know it's not working. Or if I see a play or read a script that somebody sends me that they want me to produce, right? Because we have this company. Then when it hits me like that, I'll know where it is. And like I said, it's not about sad. It's just about recognizing something good. And I think that's always been my North Star. I think that's always been North on the compass for me. And that's helped me with my writing. That's helped me with my directing. That's helped me introduce people that feel like-minded. And so if there is a magic power, I don't think it's about a skill I have as much as a gift that God or somebody gave me, which is just this truth meter that just gets it. And that might sound fucking conceited. I don't mean it to be that. I'm sorry, I'm going to source curse. I don't mean it that way. I mean, I can't explain it, but I know when things feel right because my body responds in a vibrating way. And that's been, if I have a magic power, maybe that's what it is.
I know exactly what you mean. So let me ask you this question. What is the best compliment you've ever received?
Best compliment I ever received. I wrote a script for a musical called On Your Feet. And it was about Gloria Estefan and her life. It was on Broadway for three years. Mm-hmm. And now it's going around. And I wrote a speech about immigrants that Emilio says in the musical, Emilio Estefan. And it was based on a true story that happened to him, but I made up the scene. And I wrote a monologue for him that culminated in the line, "This is what an American looks like. You should pay close attention," he's saying to a white, you know, studio, a music producer. He said, "You should look very closely at my face, because whether you know it or not, this is what an American looks like." And we were in Chicago, and this was before Trump, you know, descended the escalator, before it was in the, you know, highlighted. And the first night in Chicago, and it's not the end of the scene, it's sort of almost the end, but in the middle of the scene, but the audience in our tryout in Chicago burst into applause. And sitting in that theater, that's the best compliment I could have ever gotten. And I think it's the best compliment an artist or a writer can ever get, which is, it wasn't an applause line. It was somebody just told their truth. And the identification of that truth throughout the audience, or their affirmation of that truth, they responded in a way that you can't ask them to, which is they emoted, screamed, whooped, testified, clapped. And I think that's always the greatest in everything I've done. That's always the greatest compliment. Somebody identifies wholly with what you've written. And to me, that's one moment, but I've had a few of those, luckily. And when you hear the audience just, they can't help but react, that's a fantastic fantastic compliment.
Wow. Yeah. What's the biggest challenge you've had with a specific project right now, and how are you dealing with it?
I mean, everybody's heard this before. It's impossible to get a movie made, no matter who you are, no matter who you are. It's so difficult to get something made. You could take the meetings, you get the development. Alejandro had a tough time making Birdman, and he just made Babel and won the Golden Globe and just missed the Oscar by a hair. And he had trouble finishing the money on Birdman. I have talented friends, Rodrigo Garcia, who's an amazing writer, who did Entreatment and other things, who has a brilliant script. And he's like, I'm still trying. I'm like, holy shit. Like, if that doesn't get done, I have a few things that I'm producing from other people that I think are great. Getting a movie made is as difficult a thing as there is, even when all the elements are right. And it's heartbreaking and frustrating, and you want to punch things and cry, but that's the biggest challenge I'm facing right now on a few fronts. Movies that I respect by other people that I want to produce, a movie that I wrote, Still Life. I'm doing the screenplay of Still Life. And we've had these amazing people involved. Like, I'm not going to mention names, but huge names, and we're still circling it. Hopefully we're close, but that's the challenge. The challenge is to see it through and stick to your guns when it looks like you're screwed.
What's something that people misunderstand about you?
I think that with success, you know, when it comes to, like, you had a Broadway show, or you had, you know, your movie was, you know, you were at the Oscars or whatever. I think people presume they make an image in their head of who you are. And I'm a lonely blue collar kid from South Shore, Long Island. People just assume that you're Hollywood, or that you're like people you grew up with, or they treat you differently. Or I can't quite explain it. Ed Helms said this once to me, and he said it really eloquently, and I'm going to mangle it, but it's basically like people look at you a different way, and you're like, I'm still that same dude. I live my life as that same person. I think people don't understand that I'm them, that I'm still struggling, that I'm still feel like a fraud, that I still am scared to write every time I sit down to write, that it just somehow comes easy and blah, blah, blah. And it's not true.
I think we might have touched on this a little bit, but I'm going to ask the question anyway. Tell me about somebody who touched your heart and how they made you feel inspired to be your best self.
I mean, pick them. Yeah. My life has been a series of guardian angels. My friend Chris, I'll start with. Best friends, you heard what he did for me. Russell Siller believed me when I was a lost ragtag kid and put me on stage. My wife, when we were first married, believed in my writing. She was making all the money in her job, and I was making nothing because playwrights don't make money. And never did she make me feel less of a man about it. Never did she say, hey, listen, if this doesn't work out, we should have a backup. Never. She was just like, you sit down and do your thing, and I trust the rest will happen. I got the rest. So holy crap. That's what you want out of a partner. Danny Aiello believed in me when he had no reason to, but just loved my work and became my fairy godfather. Johnny Planko, Olivier Sultan, Alejandro. Boy, there's so many of them. I'm the luckiest son of a bitch alive, because I've had a lot of people just believe when I thought they shouldn't. And they were like, sorry, we don't care what you think. We believe anyway. And that's been my treasure. That's been my everything.
Wow. So how do you juggle family life and your career life?
My wife helps me juggle it. She works, I work. The one thing she does is she respects the insanity of my process. So when I get really intense or I start writing pages, then I'm gone. But she knows it, so we sort of prep for it. I found a hard time separating those two things. It's taken me some time. My oldest daughter is 9, and Amalia is 9, and Elena is 6. And it's taken me, you know, till last year or two to figure out what a balance is. Too many trips to LA, too many trips to London, too many trips to South Korea, too many trips, too many trips, too many trips. So the girls just don't quite get that. So it's been really difficult. So I balance it with the help of Nyla, my wife. And now I'm starting to find a little bit of more of myself and saying, no, this is family time and that's that. And it has to be sacred. I missed too many summer trips and too many trips where I have pictures of them going to Europe while I was writing a script. And at 52 years old, I'm like, no, it's okay. There's a time for this and there's time for that. And so I'm doing my best. I don't know that I have balanced it, but I'm trying.
Here's a question for you. What's a common myth that you like to debunk about our profession right now?
That anybody with an idea can write a script. You know this. Mm-hmm. You know, I see the smile in your eyes right now. Yeah. People think because they had an idea and they saw movies and they knew movies that they can write a script, and they don't care about action or conflict or reversals, and they don't care about surprising inevitability, and they don't care about character arcs, and they think, well, I have an idea, you know. And you're like, that's great. Like, everybody's allowed to write. Everybody's allowed to paint. I'm not looking down on them. But to think that it's any less of a process than being an electrician is stupid. Mm-hmm. Because you might get lucky, right? You might just write a story because you're an intrinsic storyteller and you might tell a great story. Try to do it again. It's not going to happen. Like, you need methodology. You need an understanding of what the tools in the box are. You need an understanding of what makes stories work and not work. Even if you want to blow them up, even if you want to be, you know, even if you want to be, pick your, even if you want to be Werner Herzog, or you want to be Haneke, or like, it doesn't matter. Like, you still have to have the understanding of language, of structure, of story, so that you can blow it up. And I think, you know, musicians are aware of that. There's no jazz musician that didn't study scales,
right?
Even though when they play, it's just a flurry of beautiful inspiration. And I think people often do that. And oftentimes somebody come up and say, oh, my nephew wrote a script, would you read it? And you know, you just smile and you're like, is it his first script? I'll have somebody, like, I think that's an illusion. Writing is a craft like any other craft, and you need to know the rules so that you can either abide by them or blow them up. And too many times I have people going, no, I got it, and blah, blah, blah. And then they get to act two, and like all of us, most of us survive in act two, paddling as fast as we can. Those folks just sort of drown and don't understand why they're drowning. They're like, I have another idea. And they start act one of another one because they don't realize, oh yeah, the hard part is getting across the Atlantic, not leaving the harbor, you know?
Right. Yeah, exactly.
I think that's the illusion of writing, that you don't need to study it, and you do. You just do.
Are there any funny stories or memories or characters from your life or from a job that you want to tell me about?
I'm sure there's lots of them. Which one? There was a moment on Birdman when we were shooting a really, really long take. And it was that scene where you might remember the lamp falls on the guy's head, and then Zach and Michael have this really long walk and talk, where he's like, what are we going to do? We need to get another actor, like, get me Fassbender, get me blah, blah, blah. Like, and they walk all the way through the basement up the stairs. He's like, what about him? He's like, no, he's in the Avengers. Like, damn it. They put everybody in a cape. And it goes all the way up to Michael's room. And he says, look, you're my best friend. You're my lawyer. Like, do what you do. I trust you, blah, blah, blah. And it was a really, really difficult shot. And we were on the soundstage in Queens. And Alejandro is, you know, just him and she were just trying to get it right. And you can imagine what it takes to do a scene that long, because anything can go wrong, right? And so they're doing it a bunch of times. And Nico and I were both together that day. And we were on the cans on another monitor. And Alejandro was on the other side of us, another monitor. And something, you know, cracked, or it wasn't perfect. So we went again. Position one, which is a whole beginning. Like, you have to go through the whole thing again.
Right.
So position one. So anyway, they finally get a take, and Alejandro's like, cut, I think we got it, blah, blah, blah. And Zach Galifianakis comes running around the back of me and Nico. And he's like, we need to do another take. You need to tell Alejandro. And I'm like, what? He was like, I have a thing. I got to do something with the doorway. I'm going to lean on the doorway. I was like, you tell him. He's like, no, just, I can't. You tell him. So I had to walk over to Alejandro after we got it all. And I'm like, Alejandro, Zach just came up. He just wants one more take. And Alejandro's like, okay. Like, they reset it, redid it. And Zach, it ends up being the take that's in the movie where Zach goes up and he just does this slight lean on the doorway after it's over. And it's just genius. But everybody was finally like, we got it. And then he was like, no. And I think that's just a sign of amazing artists. One, on Zach's part, to say, there's this one little thing that I could have done to make it better. And then Alejandro's to say, shit, if it's going to be better, I need it better. And we went through the whole thing and they got it in the next take. And it was that was really funny. Nico and I laugh about that still.
Wow. Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
What's one thing from writing that you didn't expect?
Success. What's one thing from writing that I didn't expect? I didn't expect to be a writer. There's a thing about writing that a lot of other people have said, and I didn't quite process, but now I do, which is that I didn't understand it, and it's important to understand that writing, when you're writing a story, somebody said, I forget who, but the story's already written, right? You're just finding it. The story exists, not meaning somebody else wrote it. I mean, the original story in your head already exists. And your job is to, like a paleontologist or whoever those, you know, dusting off fossils. Is that right?
Yeah.
Right? You have a tail and then you find the feet. Like, you don't invent it. You don't make it up as you go along, which is what it feels like. There's rights and there's wrongs. And somehow when you're doing it right, you intrinsically know what the next moment is. And that's sort of a miracle, right? How does that happen? But you're right. You say the only thing that can happen next is this. And it was an amazing lesson to me to know the more I tried to manipulate my story or my characters, the worse it became. The tighter I tried to hold that sand, the more it seeped through my fingers. So writing, to me, the surprise was that you sit back, you let your subconscious do the work, and your best idea come when you're half asleep, walking your dog, taking a shower, doing the dishes, you know, 3:30 in the morning when you wake up for 4 minutes, because your front of your brain isn't attacking it and trying to manipulate it. It just, the back of your brain just says, don't you understand? Here's what happens. And I think that's what surprised me. That's an amazing lesson about writing. The more you try to manipulate it, the less authentic it is.
I totally agree. I wrote a script. My brother hates me for it because I wrote a British comedy. I'm not British. But I love the awkward humor that the Brits have, you know, whereas American comedy, you know, you get the laugh and whatever. With British comedy, they give you uncomfortable moments that just grow and grow.
Sure. Yeah. Grow. The original Office is hard to watch. Yeah.
So I wrote a comedy like that, and my brother keeps trying to make me rewrite it because he loves the first two acts. He doesn't like the third act.
Right.
And so I keep going back and forth with him, and I go, I think it's done. I don't know what you want in this third act, but it doesn't gel with what I'm trying to put out there. So I've been working on the script for now for like 3 years. I'm going to have to send it to you now so you can.
All right. Fair enough.
But what you were saying, like, hits home. Like it's almost like I'm a schizophrenic. I just kind of sit back. I let the voices come, you know, and I get it out onto paper, and then I'll see.
Yeah, the play exists, right? You just close your eyes and imagine what happens next, and whatever you imagine, that was already there. You didn't create it,
right? It that truly hit home with me. That what you said, I'm like, oh, so someone understands what I'm going through with this. Like,
that's the dichotomy for any writers who are listening to this podcast. Like, that's the dichotomy. One is to know the rules so that you can abide by them or blow them up, right? And then once your skills are in place, once you know scales, right, then your job is to sit back and stop thinking about it. Your job is to sit back and say, here are these two people, here's this room, close your eyes and watch the scene in front of your face because it already exists. And then do your best to put that down on paper.
Yeah, that's great advice. Yeah. Wow, that's going to hit home with a lot of people.
I hope so.
If you could turn back time and talk to your 18-year-old self, what would you tell him?
I would tell him you're okay. You're not broken. You're not broken. It's going to be okay. I had a really rough upbringing. I had complicated stuff when I was 18. 18 through 30, like all I was scared. Scared that I'd be alone, scared that I was unloved, scared that I was bad, scared that I was running as fast as I could. And I would just look back and say, you're a good guy and it's going to be okay. Believe me, beyond your imagination, it's going to be okay. Just stop, and know that you're good. You're okay. That would be the most important thing I could tell myself at that age.
I'm going to take a couple steps back. I want to go back to your Gloria Estefan play. I want to know, when you wrote it, did you feel like you had to give a face to the like ethnic side of yourself and for those who are Hispanic?
I felt like they did it. Mm-hmm. I have a very strange relationship. I wrote a play about the Armenian genocide. My father's side is Armenian. I wrote a play called Red Dog Howls. And I wrote On Your Feet about the Cuban experience. My grandfather was from Havana. My grandmother was from Ponce, Puerto Rico. So that's my mother's side. My father's side is Armenian. But I grew up in a house where you weren't allowed to talk Spanish or speak Armenian. You be American, like at my age. Now it's encouraged. But when I was a kid, in the early 70s or whatever, be American, fit in, you know, so we didn't do any. I didn't even learn Spanish in a house where people just spoke Spanish. So that's how insane it was.
It's so crazy because me and my brother and sister went through the same thing. My father's from Haiti. My mother's from Panama. We didn't speak any language until 3 because, you know, they wanted us to speak English, but, you know, my mother would try to teach me Spanish. My father tried to teach me French and Creole. And it didn't take. And I feel bad now because I wish I spoke something.
Oh, my God, me too. I'm with all these folks. Like, I understand Spanish. You could drop me in the middle of a Spanish-speaking country. I'll be fine. But I'm awkward as hell. I sound stupid when I'm speaking. It's not bad, but it's passable. But all because my mother speaks perfect Spanish. My grandmother spoke perfect Spanish. It's insane. So I feel like Gloria and Emilio told that story. So I didn't feel beholden myself because I don't identify as much, but I understood it. And so I was able to embrace what it was, because that was my grandma. When they talk about, you know, somebody taking off a chancleta, which is a sandal, and throwing it, hitting somebody. Well, my grandmother did that. Like, I understood the language of it. But I think Gloria and Emilio, who, you know, we're very close friends now. We're, by the way, right now I'm just about to begin writing the film of On Your Feet. Okay. So it's exciting. But Gloria and Emilio, who I've, you know, they've become really good friends. And I can't, again, saying that out loud sounds ridiculous. Like, Gloria Estefan called my wife on Mother's Day to say Happy Mother's Day. I'm like, what kind of life is this? Who are we? But they did it. They fought that battle. And so for me, I was documenting that battle with some feeling of what it felt like to live in a Spanish home. So I didn't feel, to answer your question, I didn't feel a responsibility personally, though I want to. But I did understand it. And I fit nowhere. Alejandro and I agree on this. He's a Mexican that now doesn't fit in Mexico and doesn't fit in Los Angeles, right? Mm-hmm. He's in limbo. I was a kid that grew up in a Cuban Puerto Rican house who's distant from being that. But when I was hanging out, or I do hang out with all the white kids, when I went on my tours and I was in Arkansas, I'm not a white guy. Like, they look at me and go, what's all this with the dark and the thing? So I don't either fit in the straight American white guy or the Cuban or the Armenian for that matter. So I wrote a play. And then when I visit my Armenian relatives, I'm part of it. I was raised by my Armenian grandmother, but I don't feel Armenian. I'm, as Tony Kushner said in Angels in America, I'm part of the melting pot where nothing melted, right? I don't, I, believe me, like I make picadillo for my kids now. Like that's one of my staples to cook. Armenian, I make Armenian pilaf for my family. I go to my Armenian family on Easter. But I never belonged to any straight one group or the other. In school, they made fun of me for my Afro and my dark skin in the summer. And, you know, and I was in Long Island. So, you know.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. So I never felt like I fit anywhere. So in a way, it was it was nice because it gave me a third person perspective. And I was able to look at it both from the inside and the outside in a way.
Give me or tell the audience a little bit of advice for them if they're trying to make it. What advice would you give them?
Make it how? Is it writers? Is it actors? Is it artists?
I would say as an artist, you know, whether it be a writer or a filmmaker or a director, like I think the artists are a different kind of people that need some kind of encouragement because they feel like a fraud, like you said, and a failure.
Yeah. It's funny because this goes back to your question about what would I tell my 18-year-old self in a way. I would start by saying that each person listening to this, including you and including me, is unique. Our life experiences, I just talked about Puerto Rican Armenian, you talked about Haitian and Panamanian, your mix. Like, we're all unique, how we grew up, what we went through. We have similar life experiences, but we're all unique. And stories that you can tell as an actor, as a writer, as a director, as whatever you do, are going to be influenced by your uniqueness, because the stories are the stories. All you can bring to it is yourself, right? So I would say to them a couple of things, knowing that you're that unique. Get to theory. If you're an actor, if you're a writer, if you're a director, get to theory. Watch as many YouTube videos as you can. Read as many shitty books as you can. I don't care if it's Kill the Cat or screenplay, whatever books you want to, just read them. Read them all, even the shitty ones. Just get an idea about theory in general. And then, this is the hardest part, because most people want to make a living and most people want to get somewhere and be somewhere and they feel late. And I'm going to give a piece of advice that goes against that, which is stop trying to please people. The more you try to please them, the more you shape yourself into what you think they want. And that ugly Frankenstein creature never gets anywhere further than getting them from one thing they can make money off you from. When they say, oh, I love you, it's so original. Michael, I love your voice. I love the way you look at it. Hey, could you just flatten it out so it's not so Michael, but I love Michael, but let's have Michael. But can we just flatten out Michael so we can get to all the audiences in all the world and make all the money? And you say, well, fuck, I want a job. So yeah, let me flatten out which letter should I take out? The A in Michael or the L? Which one do you want? And that's what we do, because we're desperate to get one leg up. And then you realize the one thing that makes you special, which is the only thing that can sustain you in a life making money in the arts, which is almost impossible anyway, is your individuality, right?
Right.
So I'm asking you to do the impossible, which is, in the face of it all, don't be difficult, be there, but at all costs, preserve what's you. And you need to acknowledge what a good note is from a bad note, what commercialism is from your view, when you're selling yourself out or not. And then you can make that decision. I'm willing to sell 7% of myself out, so 93% of my thing, and I'll get a movie made. That's a decision. There's no right and wrong. It's not 100% and 0%. But you have to preserve who you are as an artist, because it is special. And the only thing you might be missing is you haven't told the story in the best way you can. You haven't acted it in the best way you can. You're so busy trying to please that you didn't sit back and let that subconscious that we were talking about before take over. An actor's in an audition room trying to impress the people behind the table. Well, that's a fucking crap setup from the start, right? That's like somebody saying, Van Gogh, come in a room. Here's a paper, paint something. Well, fuck, that's not how it works. Right?
Yeah.
They should come to you. So when you go in that room, you have to find a way to say, okay, here I am. Yes, I want the job. I acknowledge all that. Here's what I understand about the scripts. And now I'm going to let it come from back here and let it be entirely me. And if they like it, they like it. If they want a note, maybe I can adjust. But the minute you try to please, the minute you try to, it's the same thing when you're writing characters. If your characters don't make you cry or laugh or surprise you on the page, when you read it, that they say a sentence that you're like, holy shit, I can't believe they said that. If it doesn't surprise you, I swear to God, it's never going to surprise anybody. That's how it works. The subjective experience is the objective experience, right? Mm-hmm. The specific is the universal. Nobody ever did this in their shower except me. Right? Clipped your nose, clipped your nails, drank a beer. Nobody ever did this. And the minute you show a guy or a girl in a movie drinking down a beer in a shower, there's a billion people that are like, that's my favorite thing to do. And you've hit them in a specific place. My advice to the people who listen to this is, I know it's impossible. The whole journey is impossible. But if you're trying to please other people, then they're never hearing your true voice. They're hearing the voice that you want to please them with. Right? Like the bad boyfriend or girlfriend that says, you look beautiful. You're amazing. You know? And you want to be like, hey, do you think it was right to wear shorts in this restaurant? That's the person you end up marrying. Right. Don't, as much as you want the success, work on talent. Don't sell yourself. Work on theory. Work on craft. But don't give yourself up. You never get anywhere.
That's fantastic advice. Wow. I hate even asking another question because I think that's how the show should end. It should wrap up like that. Is there anything that I should have asked you that I didn't?
The question that I always, because I used to be in the audience and I used to be on the listening end of this. I still am, by the way. But I always wonder, because these things, when you listen to them or you go to a thing or you go to a seminar and they're inspiring and you get enthusiastic. And I think, the thing that I always wonder when I do these, I just did one for the Writers Guild, is I want to be sure that there's something practical that whoever's listening to this can go do right now. So the question you didn't ask me is, what's something that somebody can do right now from what you've said to take one step further today? Right? Because otherwise we're all inspired for 20 minutes and then we'll forget that we heard this, or we'll be back in our depression about how our stuff isn't getting made and everything else. So what's actionable? Mm-hmm. But I don't have any time, so don't ask me. I'm just kidding. That's what you should ask me.
Yeah. So
that's what you should always ask.
Yeah.
What they heard you. Maybe they're bored. Maybe they turned off. Maybe they're inspired. But even if they are, what next?
So what's next? Well, so I know you told me you're working on a couple of projects. Before I let you go, tell me what's next for Alex.
It's a weird time in COVID. So what's next for Alex is probably the On Your Feet screenplay. I directed a short film during the quarantine. I'm directing a film remotely from London. I started this project of 10-minute films, one from New York, one from London, one from Mumbai, India, with friends of mine. So I've been working on that. I've been working on a few different projects that I'm producing and working on producing. So I'm helping the writers as best I can. And my big writing project at the moment is On Your Feet, the film. Mm-hmm. And then I'm very close. I have an amazing producer, amazing producers helping me try to get Still Life in place so that I will direct it when we're finally clear. So that's what, and being a dad, that's what fills up my moment right now. And not to be a flirt and not to be a jerk. So the answer to the other question is, think about all that, think about who you are, and then what tonight can you do whether it's a monologue or a piece of writing or a short film that you can shoot on your iPhone, which I just shot mine on, which is incredible, but you can do something tonight and use that subconscious and, or pick up a book, a shitty book or a good book or a book on your shelf that you left, and just take that one step and tomorrow do something, like tomorrow morning, wake up and do a monologue thinking exactly what we just talked about today. What's in the back of your head, not what you want to do, what you can't help but do, what you're forced to do. Think about a short film that you could do in a monologue on a camera by yourself or somebody you're quarantined with or whatever. Do something that lets you be you, because you don't have to please anybody at the moment. You could just do it for you.
Great words of advice, Alex. Alex, thank you so much for taking the time to do this.
Michael, it was my pleasure. Thank you so much. And whenever you, you know, whenever you want to talk or chat, send me your stuff. Like, I'm always around for it. So you all can find me at my name on Twitter, Alex, not Alexander. And you can DM me or I'll follow you or whatever. Anybody can ask me stuff. I try to help as much as I can because everybody helped me. So the least I can do is try to help everybody else. So there's ways to find me.
Alex, thank you so much. For those of you listening, you've just been taken to school. I hope you listen to this podcast again, take some notes, because you've just learned from a great teacher. Alex, can you take us out?
Hey, my name is Alexander Dinolaris, and I am listening to The Quiditas Factor.
Thank you for listening to The Quiditas Factor. I am Michael J. Arboy. Before I let you guys go, please visit my website at www.mikearboy.com. That's MikeArBoue.com. And please check out the Quiditas page and go to my shop and go to Arbor Artifacts and buy a t-shirt that will help keep the show going, as well as my wife's Etsy store. That is Poem Jewelry Design. She makes wonderful jewelry. So if you're looking for something for someone, please check that out. And also, if you want to become a patron, please, by all means, check out my Patreon page. Click on the button on the website and become a patron for like $1 a month or $5 a month. You really help the show going. And I'll give you some secret tips and stuff that didn't end up in the broadcast. Tidbits of knowledge information that you might like. Please come back next Tuesday for an all-new episode of The Quiditas Factor. Thank you for listening.
Thanks so much for listening to The Quiditas Factor with Michael J. Arboway. We'll catch you next time.